While Thucydides maybe doesn't have the gods as characters, like we would find in Euripides' tragedies or in Homer's Iliad, the gods aren't agents. Thucydides has certainly removed agents from the Greek gods. But belief and practice are still...
This is the Hardcore Humanities Podcast, plus our researcher recommendations. In each episode, I'll be chatting to a researcher from one of the UK's best universities. We'll discuss their work in any topic within the humanities, and at the end of each episode, our researcher will give us some recommendations for further reading, links to which can be found on the Hardcore Humanities website and social media. I'm Jamie, and you are welcome to the podcast. Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the podcast. On today's episode, I am joined by Edward Armstrong. Edward is a classicist from St. Andrews University. Edward did his undergrad at the University of Sydney in ancient history. He then went on to do his MPhil at Sydney again in classics and ancient history. And Edward is currently studying for his PhD at St. Andrews, for which he is exploring character and rhetoric in Thucydides. So, Edward, thank you for coming on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you, Jamie. I'm very glad to be here.
So how did you come to be interested in the classics and the ancient world?
Well, I think it probably stems from a fantastic high school teacher I had, Chris Bradbury, when I was about 15. And he taught history, which was a subject that I had a vague interest in at the time. But he taught it so vivaciously that the whole class couldn't help but become interested in history. And I had another fantastic history teacher in my senior years at school who taught a lot about Roman history particularly. And I actually hadn't delved into Greek history until I was in my undergraduate when some fantastic lecturers got me interested in that. So it kind of stemmed from there. And then once I began reading ancient Greek history, I found that I loved it. I found that it was interesting, that there was so much to learn from it. It's like with any topic. The more you read, the more you realize that there's so much more to read on that topic. And that's how I felt about ancient history, particularly ancient Greek history. There's so many dimensions to it. If you're interested in in religion, you can read about Greek religion. You can find out about war and politics, democracy, tyranny, populism. There's just so many amazing topics that you can learn so much about, learn about the history and the origins of them. And as you mentioned, Jamie, I'm doing research on character and rhetoric at the moment, focusing on Thucydides' history of the Peloponnesian War. And I think anyone who reads any literature can appreciate that character and characters are so central to stories. And when it comes to it, history is about stories. And I think I'm just so interested in stories, in people's stories. And I think the more I learn about the Greek and Roman worlds, the more I've wanted to learn about them, which is why I'm still researching them.
Cool, great. So as you say, you're focusing for your PhD on Thucydides and his history of the Peloponnesian War. For listeners who aren't familiar with him and this work, can you give us a little introduction? Who was Thucydides? When was he active? And why is his history of the Peloponnesian War so important?
There's so much to say on that.
I know.
Thucydides was an Athenian, a Greek. He lived about in the sort of the mid 400s BC, and probably died around 400 or the 390s BC. So that's almost 2,500 years ago. And sort of toward, probably towards the end of his life, he began writing a history, which it doesn't seem like a big word to us, but it was actually quite a novel format for writing things down at the time. In fact, writing things down was fairly unusual unless you're inscribing them in stone in the 5th century BC. But Thucydides thought that the war between Athens and Sparta, or Athens and the Peloponnese, was important enough that he would write down a very long and quite detailed history of about sort of 27 years of war between the two big cities and their allies. And so I guess to summarize Thucydides' history, and I'm gonna do a spoiler alert for this, because you've got to find out who wins. Well, Thucydides doesn't exactly tell us who wins, because his history cuts off before the end of the war. But Sparta does win. Sparta and the allies. Athens is defeated in 404, 403 BC, which Thucydides doesn't actually record that bit. That's in Xenophon. But what we find in Thucydides is the internal politics of the Peloponnesians and the internal politics of Athens. And it is very focused on Athens, Athenocentric. But we also, we can read speeches from the leaders, the generals, the political elite. There's lots of speeches throughout Thucydides. Famously, Pericles, who was an Athenian general, gave three speeches that we have in Thucydides. And so throughout the history, you can read battles between some of the Athenians and the Peloponnesians and their allies. You can read those speeches. You can read about deliberative processes in the Athenian democracy, and so much more. So essentially, it's about this war, this 27-year war, and it's about politics, but at its heart, I think it's about people and humanity.
Okay, great. And I'm going to put to you another difficult question by asking you to briefly introduce us to another large concept, which is ancient Greek religion. Can you tell us a little more about that? I mean, we've all heard about Zeus and we've all heard of Apollo, but how did ancient Greek religion operate? Because you in your work and many others have argued that ancient Greek religion was not the same as how we in the modern world think of religion.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think ancient Greek religion has been simplified in popular culture. If you watch Disney's Hercules, for example, you see the gods, the sort of Olympic gods in their most sort of caricatured form. And that's probably how most people in society think about ancient Greek religion, that the Greeks believed that those gods lived on a mountain called Mount Olympus, and that they did religious things, kind of ritualistic things, in order to please those gods, because they believed those gods interacted with the human world. And that's quite a simplified version of ancient Greek religion. I think there's much more to it than that. Ancient Greek religion was a lived religion. It was often locally practiced, but it was also seen in sort of a concentrated form in the city-states called poleis. And you can see temples. You can see temples all across Greece still. There are ruins, a lot of them. But the Greeks built these temples because they wanted places to offer sacrifices to their gods, and it is those gods, but they wanted to be able to connect with them, I think, in a way that kind of all religions sort of seek to do that. It was a religion that people probably, well, we certainly think they believed it, those who practiced it, although there is definitely evidence of agnosticism, there is some evidence of atheism, particularly in sort of as you get closer to the 200s, 100s BC in the Greek world. That's kind of a summary of Greek religion, I think.
Okay, great. The reason I bring up ancient Greek religion is because you've done some work comparing Thucydides with the ancient Greek tragedian playwrights, specifically Euripides, and their use of religious language. Before we jump into that work specifically, I was wondering why you chose to compare these two figures, because Thucydides is writing non-fiction. He's concerned with facts and trying to tell the story of how and why the Peloponnesian War happened, I guess thinking more rationally and empirically about it, whereas Euripides is creating stories, making up characters, and essentially writing fiction. So these two different writers work in different spaces. So I was wondering why you chose those two figures specifically to compare and contrast.
Yeah, thank you, Jamie. I think the first thing to say is Euripides and Thucydides lived at about the same time, and they grew up and were shaped by the same place and the same influences. So their perspectives can't be all that different, even if they are in fact writing. One is writing fiction and one of them is writing purportedly fact. So essentially, I think the reasons I was looking for that influence, that contextual influence. And we have very scarce other evidence, written evidence from Athenian sources at the time to compare with Thucydides. Tragedies, comedies, they're contemporary enough and influenced by the same culture. So what I was looking for were linguistic similarities in the way that they talk about religious things. Because like you said, the sort of common view about Thucydides is, and this is very popular still, that he was empirical, that he was interested in facts. In fact, one of his opening chapters says that he will be not interested, not writing about essentially what we would say is myths. He's not interested in these myths. He's not interested in just things that make you be amazed and wonder at things, which is probably a bit of a dig at Herodotus, who was writing either a bit before or about the same time as Thucydides. So I think what I found in Thucydides' work were similar uses of language to talk about the gods and divine things, as well as religious concepts. So while Thucydides maybe doesn't have the gods as characters like we would find in Euripides' tragedies or in Homer's Iliad, the gods aren't agents. Thucydides has certainly removed agency from the Greek gods. But belief and practice are still evident, because what we find is that especially when disasters hit, the people often cry out to the gods, or they pray, or they invoke the names of the gods as a sort of defense mechanism, and as a sort of last resort. So when the odds are not in their favor, if they're faced with a big enemy who's coming to invade their city, they will say to that enemy, "You can't invade us, because if you do, then the gods will curse you," which we might see in popular culture, things like that. But this is actually how Thucydides describes these people arguing for peace and for not being conquered. As you can imagine, they were quite desperate in those situations. And there's many events where a smaller city or nation, I won't say nation as such, city, state, or island, is threatened with being conquered or sort of punished by a bigger city, state, And they argue that the bigger, more powerful force better not attack them, because if they do, then they'll find out actually the gods are on their side, and they'll be defeated, even though in sort of visual terms the odds are in their favor. So there's a lot of similarities there with what Euripides does. We find in his work, The Trojan Women, for example, that which is set in a kind of, it's a kind of mythological setting after the fall of Troy. So Homer's Iliad is about Troy and how the Greeks attack Troy. And then Euripides is kind of writing about what happens afterwards, because Homer doesn't really give us a whole lot of that. So after Troy is defeated. So in The Trojan Women, for example, we find the wives of the leading Trojan men, who the men are dead, they've been defeated, and the wives are left over. And their fates are quite horrible. They're going to be sold into slavery, and they really have no way of getting out of their situation. And Euripides crafts these characters as pitiable people. And in their disaster, we actually find that they cry out to the gods in the same way as the people in Thucydides' history cry out to the gods when disaster is imminent or facing them, or they have just suffered disaster. So there's similar situations there. One is fictional, one is not. But what we find is when human beings are faced with disaster, and particularly when ancient Greeks in the 5th century BC are faced with disaster, they do the same thing in reaction. So I was looking at how they speak about the gods, how they speak about their belief in fortune and misfortune, how they speak about hope as a real expectation, and that's often hope linked to divine favor, linked to fortune, I think there's such overwhelming evidence of that linguistic similarity. We have to say that in both Euripides and Thucydides, the same religious understanding of the world, the same religious perspective is there, even if perhaps the authors may not have agreed on all aspects of Greek religion. Yeah, I hope that answers your question.
Okay, yeah, and I also would like to push you a little further on it and ask, why is that important? Why is the link between disaster and religious language in these texts so important? Because just to almost pull it into the modern day, this link between disaster and religion, I would say, is quite acknowledged and almost kind of obvious. For example, I have a friend who's would describe himself as he would say that he was baptized, but he went to a Catholic school, but he's not necessarily a Catholic. Yet a few years ago, his dad had a heart attack, and my friend said that he prayed for his dad. His dad was okay in the end, by the way. Also, the Catholic practice of confession deals with a similar thing, disaster or general negative emotional feeling, you know, and there is that practice built into Catholicism to help people cope with difficulty. And I would argue Buddhism is almost entirely oriented towards what they call noble truth number one: life is suffering. That's to say that life has so much potential for disaster and terrible things to happen. So this link between religion and disaster, I think, is quite well established. You might even say that religion at heart is purely a coping mechanism. So with all that in mind, why is it important that we see this link with regards to Thucydides and the Tradians?
What my research was reacting to was this, as I said earlier, this common view that in Thucydides we find an exception to the kind of general rule of overwhelming religiosity in ancient Greece. So in Thucydides, as I said, there's no the agency of the gods, which we find elsewhere in tragedy and in epic poetry like Homer's Iliad, that agency is gone, and the gods are not characters. They are mentioned, but usually only in reference to their temples or perhaps in reference to sort of profanities and things like that. But what we find is this presence of religious belief. And I think you're right that there's definitely a kind of universal application to the idea of when disaster strikes or danger is imminent, people who may not necessarily be used to praying will start doing so. In fact, someone after I gave a talk on this topic came up to me and said something quite similar to what you did. She said that she finds it interesting when she's on an aeroplane and there's turbulence and you see people start sort of mouthing prayers as you're experiencing that turbulence, because they're obviously scared of turbulence or flying or something, and they're turning to a power that's beyond them and greater than them. And I think that's quite normal. That's quite human. Even when we're children, if we see danger, we might run to our parents because they are a bigger, stronger force that we can rely on at the time. And I think the point of that research was to show that kind of common view about Thucydides' history as a sort of empirical historical text that is entirely devoid of religion is just not true. And that's kind of what I set out to prove, because I was actually on a holiday in New Zealand and I was reading Thucydides, as only probably a classicist would do, or a retired person maybe. And I'd been taught this common view all through my undergraduate degree, and I thought, I just don't agree with it. And in fact, I think it's so wrong that I'm going to write a paper on it. And I ended up writing my entire master's on that topic. So that was kind of what I was reacting to. In a more general sense, I think there's definitely applicability to understanding how ancient religions worked. In fact, the most popular religions of the world are ancient religions. Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism. These are fairly ancient religions. And if we want to understand the world, I think we can't ignore the beliefs in God that people have, and God and gods. And I think it's important to understand other people. And so I guess in a sort of wider sense, my research is speaking to these questions about humanity and our search for understanding who God is.
Okay. And I would like to hear you elaborate on the fact that in Thucydides, he writes of the futility of praying to the gods. Is there some significance in the fact that he does that? Because, as you say, in mythology, okay, sometimes the gods will ignore your sacrifice, but sometimes they do intervene and they do sway the balance of a situation. So is it significant that Thucydides is basically saying the Athenians prayed to this god and the Spartans prayed to that god, but ultimately it made no difference? Is that quite a divergent view from the ancient Greek view at the time, that praying to the gods would make no difference?
I mean, I think it's quite difficult to say how many of the Greeks, and whether a majority of them, believe that praying to the gods, their gods, affected anything. But I think what we can see in the fact that there are so many temples, there are so many shrines to heroes and gods scattered throughout Greece, even today, there are so many remnants of these shrines and temples. We can see that religion was important to them. And whether they thought in their day-to-day life, I'm going to pray for this so that this happens because this God that I'm going to pray to can make that happen, I don't think we can know that. But what we can see is that there certainly was some religious belief, because you wouldn't put all of your resources for years and years into building an enormous temple in order for you to be able to sort of go to a place and sacrifice in order to please gods if you didn't really believe in them. I think that's quite a naive view that some people have, that the Greeks weren't actually religious. I think that ignores a lot of material evidence. And in fact, as I argued in my master's thesis and have done in a couple of conference papers, I think we can see in the literature that religion was important to the Greeks, or at least assumed to them, that it was assumed that people believed in the gods. It was assumed that if you sacrificed to Zeus, that you could ask a favor of him, and you were more likely to get that favor than if you hadn't sacrificed to him. And I think prayer probably meant a different thing to the ancient Greeks than it does in our kind of Western context, which is definitely more shaped by a Christian understanding of prayer.
Yeah, it also might be worth pointing out here that when we talk about ancient Greece and the ancient Greeks, we are talking about a very large period of time, aren't we? Mm. Obviously, mm-hmm. let's just say the 10th century BC Greece was different to the 1st century BC or even AD, you know? Mm-hmm. So how does that come into the conversation here?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we look at evidence for Greek religion, it definitely shows developments, changes in practice over time and in different spaces as well. I'm talking about Greece, but Greece wasn't a nation in the ancient world as a sort of unified whole. It was a cultural people group, and it was divided into what we call city-states, which were essentially large cities and their surrounding territories. And the biggest ones would be familiar to most people. Most people would know that Athens was a big city in the ancient world, and it was, for most of ancient history that we know of. But we do have some interesting examples of practices of Greek religion, which kind of give us insight into those developments. For example, in Thucydides' history, and this is one of the passages I've researched quite a bit, the Spartan king Archidamus actually prays to the gods and heroes of a local land because he and his army are about to conquer the city on which that land rests. And he wants to sort of clear his conscience before he does that. They're not his gods. He actually says that they are the Plataean gods, so the city of Plataea, which I think still exists, actually. But it was conquered by the Spartans in about 427 BC, I think. And before they did that, their king prayed for a sort of favorable victory. And he prayed to, I guess, what would have been to him, foreign gods, because they were of that land. They were given that sort of epithet, that kind of name, because they were like local gods, local deities. And then if we look back further than that, we can see an example in the Iliad of Helen of Troy and some of the other Trojan women giving prayers and sacrifices in the temples to the Trojan gods. And it looks different because we know that in that circumstance, they were in a city, they were in a temple, they were doing things there, and they sort of felt connected to their gods through that physical space. Whereas Archidamus in Thucydides is actually in a foreign land. He's not in a temple when he gives that prayer. He probably poured out a libation. So he probably had a cup of some sort of drink and poured out a bit of it in that prayer. And so we see that religion is practiced differently across different space and different time.
Yeah, I think what you've just said there really highlights that. It's almost like trying to imagine, and this is quite difficult to imagine, which, as I say, just proves the point that you're making. It's like imagining a modern Christian going to a Buddhist temple or something and actually praying to Buddha. it just like wouldn't happen.
Of course not.
it doesn't make like religious sense in the 21st century. So that just proves how different their conception of religion was. I guess the question that I asked you earlier about Thucydides and his writing saying that it's the futility of praying to the gods and how in the end the prayers didn't make any difference. What I'm wondering is he discrediting the whole notion of the ancient Greek pantheon, and was he doing that intentionally? And I guess the reason I ask you that is because this kind of period that he was writing could be the start or part of the story of Greek rationalism and philosophy, and lots of historians have argued that once that started to grow, it was kind of the nail in the coffin for belief in the ancient Greek gods. And I'm wondering if Thucydides, by claiming that it's futile to pray to these gods, is part of that story?
Yeah, I think Thucydides certainly represents the atmosphere, the sort of intellectual atmosphere of his time. And what was happening in Athens in the 5th century BC when he was alive and living there before he was exiled is that the sophists, so we've got Gorgias, who was from Sicily, and you've got Protagoras and Prodicus of Chios. These sophists and others like them were bringing in ideas which challenged established notions of how we understand the world. And it's commonly understood that the sophists were kind of a-religious or agnostic. And then, of course, you see the development after the 5th century with Socrates, who was put to death for impiety and apparently leading the youth away from traditional religion. So you can see that there's two sort of narratives at work there. There's certainly developments in understanding how the world works and how humans and the divine interact, which you could definitely see a kind of trajectory towards maybe say philosophical naturalism or something close to humanism. But I think at the same time, it's not exactly linear. It's not exactly like it kind of builds and builds and builds, and now we've finally got the finished product of humanism or naturalism. I think it's much more complicated than that. And of course, if you look at the grand scheme of history, you certainly couldn't say that religions have just disappeared over time, because of course, I'm talking about Thucydides in the 5th century BC, and then you get Christianity popping up about 400 years later and developing. And so there's certainly lines of thinking and narratives about the world and humans and the divine which begin to develop in the 5th century BC, and Athens being this kind of center of agnostic thought. And Tim Whitmarsh's book, from I think 2015, which I'll find the title of, kind of explores this idea of atheism in the ancient world. But I think it is a little bit more complex than just a linear movement towards humanism. Tim Whitmarsh's book is called "Battling the Gods: Atheism in the Ancient World," and it was 2015. I was right.
Cool. That sounds good. I will have to check that out. So my last question before we get onto the research recommendations is concerned with another aspect of your work, and that is how the ancient Greeks did history. Now, Thucydides, and you also mentioned Herodotus and Xenophon, these are considered the fathers of history. Do you think that's accurate? Are we still doing history the way that they did it?
Yes, if you look at the way that writing developed in the Western world throughout ancient history, and the kind of extant evidence we have, the surviving bits and pieces, the history that's being written today is not all that dissimilar, and probably the closest to what Thucydides and Herodotus were doing in the 5th century BC, as kind of compared to any other literature from that time and since. But I think history has also developed in a lot of ways now because writing is so prolific.
Okay, cool. Let's do the researcher recommendations. Now, you already did give us one recommendation there, but do you have two more? Do you have your first researcher recommendation?
Yes, absolutely. If you're interested in Greek religion, ancient Greek religion, then you should definitely check out Julia Kint's 2012 book, Rethinking Greek Religion. And if you're interested in rhetoric, in character, and in Athenian democracy, then check out the book Performance Culture and Athenian Democracy, edited by Robin Osborne and Simon Goldhill.
Okay, amazing. Edward, thank you very much for coming on. Fascinating talk. I wish you all the best with the future of your studies.
Thank you so much, Jamie. It's been a pleasure to be on here.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you have enjoyed it, please do us a massive favor and tell all of your friends about the Hardcore Humanities podcast. You could also give us a good rating or review and follow us on social media. And don't forget to check out our researcher recommendations. Until next time, ciao for now.